Hi, listeners of M-Cubed, Murder, Mystery, and Mayhem.
We're friends of the pod. Allow us to introduce ourselves.
I'm Beth.
And I'm Bailey.
And we are True Crime B&B. We do a podcast every week. We release on Fridays.
And every week we'll bring to you two different true crime stories.
First, we'll bring you a disturbing story.
And then one that will hopefully uplift your spirits a little bit.
We'd love to have you listen to our podcast.
Yeah, so join us every week on Friday. Find us anywhere you find your podcasts, on Spotify, Apple,
Google Podcasts.
I don't know anywhere else.
And also you can find us on Instagram, Twitter, or Facebook at True Crime B&B.
Did we even mention that we're mom and daughter?
No. I hope you join our crime family. Bye.
Bye.
Hey, Sam.
Hey, Paige.
What you doing?
Not mounting a horse head on my wall.
God, I hope not.
If you listened to the last episode, you would know.
If you know, you know. So, what are you doing, Sam?
We are recording a podcast.
Oh, what's it called?
M-Cubed.
Murder, Mystery, Mayhem.
Fuck yeah.
The ad you listened to earlier was True Crime B&B. Beth and Bailey.
We love them.
Mom and daughter.
Yes.
The best duo.
They really are.
I love them so much.
Yes.
Beth, well, they switch, don't they?
Every once in a while they do, but Beth typically does the more uplifting true crime, mm-hmm. where at the very end of the story it's like something positive happened, like somebody survived, or they become just straight up badass. They're just an amazing advocate. And then Bailey does the not so uplifting true crime. But you should definitely give them a listen because they're fantastic. And their research is amazing.
And their bloopers at the end are hilarious.
They really are.
I still gotta get a new fridge.
If you know, you know.
Ha!
What?
We didn't say follow their Instagram because it's lit.
I got it, though.
I should have talked more quietly.
I'd make it a bitch louder. I can do lots of things in this program now. So, do we got any news, Paige?
Yes, we should have said this last episode, but we kind of forgot. We have hit 1,000 downloads.
Yeah!
We're over 1,000 downloads.
Yeah, we are. We're like 1,200 now.
Yeah.
It makes me happy. Mm-hmm. Yep, shit ton of countries. And only 13 states left, is that right?
12.
12, mm-hmm. Yeah. The ones we have left are Maine, Vermont, Rhode Island, West Virginia, Louisiana, Kansas, North and South Dakota, Wyoming, Arizona, Oregon, and Alaska. And we are in 25 countries and 38 states.
Sweet.
Yeah, that's pretty exciting.
Yeah.
Oh, and we found out today that we are actually on the True Crime Good Top Pods. 100 and Good Pods. Mm-hmm. And
91. We're 91 on the Good Pods comedy.
Oh, yeah. And then, I was going to say, and then we're also on the list for comedy, which cracks me up because, dumbassery are us here. We are also going to do a giveaway and tell them how to get entered in for this giveaway.
Okay. To participate.
To participate. Yeah.
You just have to go to our Instagram. Mm-hmm. Of course, follow us first, guys. Come
yeah.
on. And you'll find the post with our sticker on it. Just like, share, and comment.
Mm-hmm.
Comment. What
your favorite phrase from our from our dumbassery.
Hey, that works.
What's your favorite M-Cubed moment?
All the times that Sam says penis.
Tiny dick man. Yeah. Yeah, anyway, do that, and there is going to be 5 winners, and we will announce the winners on Wednesday, July 20th. So, 2 weeks away! Mm-hmm. Yay! What else we got?
Okay, I want to give a shout-out to Amanda.
Hey, Amanda.
Yeah, hey, Amanda from Nebraska. She is getting married soon.
Yeah!
And we just want to say congrats on your wedding. We hope everything goes smooth. Try not to freak out! You got this, woman.
Use your best friend to be the bitch. It's fine.
Yeah. Patreon.
Oh, yeah. And we have Patreon coming up. We're going to launch that on August 1st.
Not 7th.
Not the 7th. But I figured I would tell you a little bit about the tiers. We're going to have two tiers. The first one is like the $2 tier. So you'll get the extra content of our absolute dumbassery. There will be at least one extra episode a month. We are going to try to shout everybody out, but if we ever miss you, just let us know nicely. Because if you are rude, I will purposefully leave your name off.
No, you can talk rude to me. It's fine. Tell me how much you hate me. I like it.
We're not sharing our kinks today, okay?
Sorry, my bad.
And then the next tier up, the second one, is $4, and you will get quarterly stickers. And these stickers are Paige's designs of awesomeness.
I don't know if we'll go that far.
Yeah.
But they are somewhat designed, yes.
They are absolutely fantastic.
Stop, I don't like compliments.
You want me to be mean to you?
Yes, do it.
But you guys, anyone that's in the Patreon will have the priority case suggestions, so we'll pull those out first. And yeah, you get more of our dumbassery. Yay!
Woohoo!
Yeah. What else?
Did I have one other thing?
I think so. I feel like there was something else.
No, that's all I got.
Cool.
Don't look at me like that, Sam.
I'm sorry.
I don't want to start it yet. We're having fun. Why you gotta bring us down for?
We are a true crime podcast. And listen, splitting it up in multiple parts is a lot better than having one, like, 8-hour version of this bullshit. Because let's be honest, nobody really wants to, like, dive that deep into it.
Fine. Go ahead, start part two. Recap it for us, Sam.
All right, so part one, we covered Willie Picton's life, essentially, up to mid-90s, I think.
Fucking 90s.
And we saw how he grew up, how much of an asshole he and his brother were, how confusing as fuck Willie is with his choice of having random females around but not killing them. But like last time, I'm gonna say all the triggers. Like, this one's gonna be a little bit worse than the last one as far as details on certain aspects, and I'm just gonna go ahead and apologize. Like, I can't. I'm sorry.
I just had my mega pint of wine.
You need to keep drinking.
Yeah,
keep going. I didn't get my shot of tequila.
shot.
Everybody. Anyway, so if you haven't listened to part one, you should probably go back and listen to that hour and a half episode of Willie Picton's life and the ridiculous shit that he and his brother got into and got away with, and then also get angry at the police department in this area because nobody gives a fuck that a shit ton of women have been murdered and are missing. That sound like a good recap?
Yes. Okay. Very good recap.
All right, we'll get into this shit show. And right off the bat, all the triggers, because this is a story of one of his surviving victims. I'm gonna try not to sigh so much in this one, but I keep doing
it. Just think, once we get this done, you don't have to think about Willie Picton ever again.
That's true. All right. So on March 22nd, 1997, a woman named Sandra Gill Ringwald, who was a sex worker, she got up, got ready for her day, and took her drug of choice, which happened to be a speedball, and I didn't know what that was. Like, I knew what a speedball, I knew it was drugs, but I didn't know exactly what it was. Apparently, it's a mixture of cocaine and heroin. So she decided to sneak over to the casino and try her luck at some gambling. Unfortunately, she lost about $60, and so she had to go back out, try to get that money back, because she needed to bring money home to her boyfriend / pimp, so they could have drugs and do whatever the fuck else they were doing. So she went out and found her stash, because she needed to pick me up before she headed back out to the strip, which is downtown Eastside in Vancouver. And it wasn't long before a man in a red Chevy pickup truck stopped and asked the price for a blowjob. She described this man as having shoulder-length, dirty blonde hair. She estimated his height to be just a couple inches taller than her, so she wasn't really afraid of him. She told him it would be $40 for a blowjob, and then he asked the price for more. She told him, he had told her that he would like to take her back to his place in Port Coquitlam and return her by 1 a.m. And he would give her $100 for her time. She decided this would be a great opportunity because she had lost the $60. She'd make that up. And then she would have an extra $40. So, like, win-win, right? On their way, the man told her, "Everybody calls me Willie." He let her have some Smarty candies that he had in the car and the soda. And they kind of did a little chit-chatting on the way. Nothing too crazy. So they got into Port Coquitlam and they got closer to a gas station. She's like, "Hey, I've really got to use the bathroom. Can you pull over here?" And he's like, "No, we're close to my house. You could just use it there." When they arrived, you had to go through a gate. So he had to get out, open the gate, get back in the truck, move it a little bit, and close it. Well, while he was doing that, she noticed that there was a white car that was parked close to the trailer. Now, he got back in and he went and parked in front of the trailer. They went in, he checked his voicemails. Once he was done with that, he led her back to his room, which didn't have a bed. It only had sleeping bags, which was odd. She also noticed that there was a thick roll of clear plastic that was next to the sleeping bags. He gave her the $100 and they had sex. There wasn't anything particularly remarkable about it, and in fact, she would later say it lasted maybe 5 minutes. Afterwards, she asked to use the phone. He told her no, because he had been burned by another woman before. She had made long-distance calls, and it cost him a lot of money. So he was like, "No." But we could stop at a payphone nearby on the way back to Vancouver. She's like, "Well, I still need to use the bathroom." So she goes to use the bathroom, where she attempts to shoot up, but... And, like, at the back of her leg, too. But she happened to miss a vein, so she didn't get that high. So when she was in there getting... She was a little irritated that she didn't get high from shooting up and wasting that product. She goes back out, and she's like, "Hey, since you won't let me use the phone, can you let me use the phone book so I can get the number?" He's like, "Sure." So he leads her over to the desk, pulls out the phone book for her. She's flipping through it. She's kind of standing and leaning over the desk. Well, Willie comes up behind her, starts to rub her hand, and she assumes that he's trying to be sweet or some shit, and she was getting kind of annoyed because she'd already been paid. She was ready to go. But this was anything but sweet. He grabbed her arm, put a handcuff on her wrist. He went to grab the other one, but she fought so fucking hard. She remembered seeing the knife in the kitchen on the kitchen counter, or table. It may have been the table. She managed to maneuver their little fight over to the table. She grabs at the knife, was able to get it, and she starts slashing at him wildly. Mm-hmm. She makes contact with his neck and his face, and then he yells out, "You fucking bitch, you got me good." He grabs a rag, covers his wounds, and then continues to attack Cassandra. At some point during the fight, she loses consciousness or blacks out, but when she comes to again, they were outside by his truck. She still had the knife in her hand, and though she was bleeding terribly, so was he. Again, by some crazy random happenstance, he started losing consciousness from the blood loss because she had stabbed him a lot. Yeah. So she was able to slide away from him. She booked it. She ran through the gate. Obviously, she like jumped it, but she got through the gate, and she sees two houses across the street with lights on. So she runs toward them, or at least as much as she can while she's injured. No sooner than she got there, she saw headlights, so she quickly ducked, assuming that it was him coming back for her. Though, when it passed, she was able to see there was a woman in the car. So she took her chances. She ran out screaming for help, knife in her hand still, just wildly just trying to get their attention and get them to stop. It happened to be an older couple. And what they saw, a woman, half naked, bleeding, literal guts hanging out, waving a knife in the air. The man said, "Please don't stab us." And she throws the knife. She drops it. The man then gets out of the car, like, pushes shit into the, from the back seat into the floorboard so he could get her in the car and lay down. Then they call 911 as they're heading to the hospital.
Yeah.
An officer, officer and ambulance meet them. She's then transported to the hospital. And they amazingly saved her life. Like, she probably should have died.
Right.
She had a shit ton of blood loss. But anyway, while she was there, the officers took her clothes for evidence, and they noted there was a handcuff still on her wrist. She didn't have a key to it, so it just kind of stayed there for a minute. Shortly after, that same officer was called because there was a second patient being admitted into the same hospital with stab wounds. And he was being transferred from Eagle Ridge Hospital in Port Moody. The hospital in Port Moody was smaller, so they didn't really have the capacity to deal with the injuries that he had. They get him there, they perform surgery and whatnot. The officer collects his clothes and notice that in his pocket there is a small key. You know, like a handcuff key. Very similar to the ones that law enforcement officers use. So he takes the key over to Sandra and fucking unlocks the handcuffs.
So he put that together.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens to Willie? Jack shit?
Well, we'll get there, but we're going to talk about Sandra first. She decided that she was going to take some time in the hospital as a way to kick her addiction. And she did that for a while. She and her ex, which was also her children's father, decided that she would move in with him and stay off drugs and stay off the streets. Unfortunately, that didn't last very long. And she started a methadone program and soon went back to the lower tracks, but not as a sex worker, but as a drug dealer. She was still terrified of Willie. Willie, on the other hand, was kept in the hospital for 3 days and then released to his brother. His story goes a little bit like this, and I'm going to quote it from the book. I was in Vancouver, having a little rest in my pickup, and a prostitute knocks on the window. She wakes me up. How much, I ask. She says, 200. So I says, okay. We go back to the trailer. She went into the bathroom and shot herself up. When she came out, she wanted, well, I had some money on the table. I always had cash on me. I had put $3,400 on the table. There was a knife there. She took the knife and said, I want my money up front, and grabbed at the money. I tried to take the knife away. She starts stabbing me, so I grab it and try to protect myself. She ran out of the trailer, ran to the booze can where the bikers are. She broke a window. An older couple took her to the hospital. I drove to the police station. I forgot it had moved. So I went to the Eagle Ridge Hospital and nearly bled to death on the way. I needed over 300 stitches. There seems to be a few plot holes in his story. Just a few. But his family and friends were like, what a bitch.
Could they not do like a, what's it called, rape kit? To see, I know she wasn't raped, but they had sex. Could they not take a specimen and be like, oh yeah, there's a big ass plot hole here?
They probably could have, but
why the fuck would they?
Yeah. Oh, so she chose not to tell the officers that she was there for, sex work. So they wouldn't take the $100 that Willie had given her.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. That's why.
So, as I said, his friends and family decided that, okay, fuck her. But I guarantee they knew what the fuck he was doing.
What about the handcuffs? How did he explain the handcuffs?
Oh, he didn't explain the handcuffs to his friends and family. Fuck that. He left that big-ass thing alone. Somehow, Dave was able to get Lisa Yields, his friend that was... We talked about her in the first part. She had moved from Port Coquitlam to Surrey, I think it was. And so Dave was like, hey, if you come up here and take care of Willie while he's recovering, just for a few days, like, I'll pay for the insurance, because she didn't have car insurance at the time. He's like, I'll pay for the car insurance during that time. I'll give you money, whatever. She's like, okay, it's Willie. So she goes and takes care of him, and she never gets paid. Because, you know, another dick move from the Picton brother. But Willie's injuries were actually pretty intense. He had cuts to his face that led to him having to have a lot of dental work done. Like, she cut into his jaw.
Good.
And sliced some of his teeth. Mm. So, if you're feeling bad for him, you should go ahead and put yourself into some sort of psych ward because, you know, or go and confess your own crimes because something's wrong with you. So, charges were brought against Willie.
Oh, good.
Yes. But the day of court, where Sandra was supposed to testify, she did not show up.
Which is normally what happens.
So, like most cases like this, it was fucking dismissed.
Yeah.
How about we stop that shit? Like, look, obviously, if they were attacked to the point where they were in the fucking hospital, they're probably going to be afraid and have some major PTSD. Mm-hmm. But he was out and about this entire time, too, by the way.
Made bail.
Yeah. Like, there was nothing. So, once again, he gets a slap on the wrist and he gets to do whatever the fuck he wants because he got lucky again, I guess. Or, really, it's not luck. It's a strategic move on his end because he chooses sex workers to assault. And none of law enforcement, at least the higher ups, some of the lower level ones were advocates for the sex workers, but the higher ups were like, they're beneath us.
If it was a doctor's kid.
Oh, it'd be.
Solved in 2 days.
He would have never left. He would have never left the jail.
Yeah.
So after all of this, you would think that women would stay the hell away from him? The answer is no. You know why? Because when they printed the story about Sandra Gale's attack, they didn't fucking name him.
Uh-uh.
They didn't name him. Also, he ended up finding a woman named Gina Houston, who was pretty shitty, if I'm honest. She became really close to Willie, mostly for the money that he would just willingly give out and the drugs. But she would find women who were in need of a fix or in need of money. And she'd be like, hey, I know a guy. She called him Uncle Willie, I think. It's so gross. I hate it so much.
Very fucking disturbing, Sam.
I know. So she claims that they never had a sexual relationship, but at one point she would randomly call herself, use the last name Picton. They were never married. She was psychotic. But she was also very jealous of any of the women that would come around.
So but like, she would bring them around?
Well, okay. She would bring them there. He'd get his blowjob or whatever. And then they would leave. But the ones that consistently started coming around at the parties and all of that shit, she didn't like it. So a lot of the women, where she would find them actually was the women's advocacy center type thing. Like I said in the last episode, it's where they would be able to take a shower and get a hot meal and be able to get ready for the day. And also, they had a doctor, come in and check everybody out. But anyway, she would go to these places and, again, she would find the women that were in need of a fix or money or whatever. And a lot of times, the women would go. But some of them were smart and stayed away from Willie, because he was on that do not fuck list. But money is money.
Money is money.
Drugs are drugs. So if it was going to be free drugs, they were like, can't be that bad, right?
Nothing's free.
Nothing's free. In the book that I referenced in the last episode, the book is called On the Farm by Stevie Cameron. And it spoke about this time from 1978 to 1997, I think it was, there were 48 women missing from downtown Eastside. Though it wasn't unusual for women to go missing, but there wouldn't be as high a number. It would be like a couple a year or something like that. Some of them had overdosed and had a different ID on them or no ID at all. Mm-hmm. So they were like Jane Doe's. Mm-hmm. Or they decided to just quit that life and move off somewhere. In fact, actually, I think the total of missing women that they were actually looking at toward the end was about 65, and there were like 69, and 4 of them were found later on.
That's good.
Yeah, and they didn't realize they were on the missing list.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And you said there was like, 4 active serial killers at that time?
Uh-huh. Yeah, there was the one that was targeting children. There was one they called the Valley Killer, I think it was. I'm going to dig into that one because there was like 4 victims. And I'll talk about it in a minute. But they tried to use DNA to prove that it was Willie, but it wasn't. Then there was the other one that was using alcohol to poison them to death. And then Willie. And I feel like there was probably another one, but, you know, in this time frame, that's enough.
Yeah, that's definitely enough.
More than enough. There were 13 missing women in 1997 alone. So it went from a couple a year to 13. And then by July 1998, there were 5 more missing women in this area. I don't understand how this didn't raise a shit ton of red flags. I mean, I kind of do, actually. Let me preface this by saying some of these women, a lot of them actually, lived kind of chaotic lives, so nobody really knew where they were staying permanently, or they didn't have a permanent place to stay. They didn't have a fixed routine, and they would just go away. And so it could be a week, a month, years before they're ever reported missing. So some of these numbers are a bit skewed, because later on we find out that some of these women disappeared years before, and they just didn't realize it because they had dropped off with their family. They didn't continue speaking to them or something. And so when their family finally tried to reach out to them, they were nowhere to be found. But there was one officer. His name was McKay Dunn. I think that was his last name. McKay Dunn. He worked in the area and happened to be, he wanted to see if there was a connection with all of the missing women. So he tried to build a case and present it to the higher ups to try to convince them. It did not go well. They didn't have a serial killer. Not one, not four, none. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But they were just sex workers. They were drug addicts. They didn't matter in the grand scheme of things. So in 1997 or 1998, a woman named Sarah DeFries went missing. Her family members and really good friends went to the police. When they didn't do anything, they started talking to reporters, which is the best thing they could have ever fucking done.
Yeah.
Though, still, at this point, they didn't make the link between Sarah and the other missing women. Mostly because no one, again, wanted to look deeper into it. But there was one, there were a few reporters, but one that wrote the most articles, his name was Lindsay Kynes, and he somehow managed to get someone at the police department to mention that they were bothered by the number of disappearances and actually gave him information on some of the missing women. Though, it was not a realistic number. They said there were only 16 missing women. And this is fucking ridiculous all in itself. I promise there's a reason I go into these little tangents. I need you to understand my whole ass picture, because Willie Picton is just the tiniest little dick man over here. But there's so many people involved, and so many people could have helped had they listened to people like Officer Dunn, or the woman who runs the Women's Advocacy Center, or the doctor that would regularly meet with these people on the downtown east side. They knew something was wrong. Those higher ups were like, fuck off. We don't have a problem. So after he released his story titled Police Target Big Increase in Missing Women Cases, he received a call on July 28th.
Oh, I bet he did.
1998 from a man named Bill Hiscox. The last names in this are great.
Sam.
I am a child. Anyway, Bill called Kynes to tell him that this guy he worked for named Willie Picton, or rather he worked for Dave, but had dealt with Willie during his time there, like 1997 and 1998. He told him that Willie was a strange man, and he's convinced that he has something to do with the disappearances.
Oh, really?
1998, just want to point that out. He told Kynes that Willie had a ton of women's clothing scattered around, and wallets and IDs and purses. And he thought it was just crazy that just a year before, he had been charged and got away with attempted murder of Sandra Gale.
Boom, boom, boom.
So he put the links together regarding his frequent trips to the downtown east side and the missing women, because nobody was really looking for him for these at this point. Apparently, Kynes wasn't his first phone call, though. He had called the police after he spoke with one of Sarah's friends, and the officer that he spoke to was Al Howlett. I feel like I'm saying Owlette. Anyway, at this time, he was told, meaning Hiscox was told, that they would check into this Willie Picton character.
They never did.
If they did, I don't think there's any record of it.
So were they?
Or they were like, hey man, are you involved in the disappearances? No, I wouldn't do that. Okay.
Were they participants in the Piggy Palace?
Possibly.
Because, you know, there were law enforcement officers and other public officials that would use that area. So, you know, you remember that badass team that I talked about in the first part with all the what word am I talking about?
Say it again.
Profilers. Haha, that's okay. The word I was looking for.
Yeah.
So you remember in part one where I talked about the profilers that got together and they had made profiles and they were convinced that there was at least one serial killer in this area at this time, but probably more like three.
Perfectly described, Willie.
Yeah, I don't think they got that deep into it, but one of those people, his name was Kim Rosmo. He was called a geographical profiler, and he actually created a program that if you list where attacks happen for a particular set of violent crimes, he could give you a generalized location of where the perpetrator would live.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
That's some Spencer Reed shit.
Yes. So he ended up getting a nice office after he had graduated with his PhD. He was fucking intelligent. He was even able to get interns or whatever to come in and help work on certain things. But you know what the Vancouver Police Department did not do?
What?
They did not utilize him at all because the higher-ups didn't want that new technology to take over the policing. They didn't want that new stuff.
You can't take my job.
Exactly. So they made his life a living hell.
That's fucked up.
But he was a badass. And he helped. And I think by the time they ended up firing him. Yeah.
They fired him?
I'll get to that in a minute. Like probably in part three. But by the time they ended up ending his contract, he had helped with 1,700 cases worldwide. 1,700 cases.
So he
but
has
Vancouver PD was like, fuck you!
Because they didn't want to do shit.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't want it. They didn't want the cases to be solved because they didn't want to work. So when he started showing up and actually solving cases,
mm-hmm.
they were like, no, homie, that's not what we do here.
The more praise he got, the worse it was for him.
We just eat donuts here.
Mm-hmm.
Donut club. And go to the Piggy Palace.
Yep. It just makes no sense. Like, they could have saved so many lives.
They didn't care.
They didn't give two fucks.
Well, some of them cared.
Yeah. Some of them did. But it was the ones that didn't have the authority.
The ones that were actually probably doing shit.
Yeah. So the officer that I talked about earlier, McKay Dunn, he actually worked on the Lower East Side, so he knew the women and everything. So he's like, I'm convinced that there is something going on. So he reached out to Rosmo. And at this time, Rosmo was traveling to a few different countries, doing his seminars and all of this stuff. Well, finally, he was able to get back in September, I think. And he was like, the moment he got into the office, he was like, hey, send me some stuff and I'll look into it. And I'll get back to that in just a second. But Kynes, the reporter who was trying to piece everything together, he obviously wasn't the only one, but there were like three other reporters that the families had talked to. Kynes released another article on September 18th, 1998. And although the first article had some major backlash with the police department because they're not doing shit, and there's at least 16 women that they're admitting to that are missing, they were still not even attempting to rub two tiny little brain cells together and admit that they might actually have a serial killer. Because there were no bodies. They said because there were no bodies, there wasn't a killer. These women probably just went off and decided to change their lives.
Okay.
So because they got the backlash, they were like, okay, okay, okay. Pat the whole community on the head. Okay, we'll put a team together. They two-man team to focus on the missing women.
Oh God, what do they do?
Absolutely fucking nothing. because people like Inspector Fred Biddlecomb, again, surnames are killing it. This tiny dick little motherfucker, Inspector, wanted to be like, oh, these women could have disappeared for a plethora of reasons. he probably didn't know the word plethora, but, you know, I'm throwing that in there. Anyway, he was like, they could have just run off. They could have died. They could have been in the hospital and just not had ID. They could have just, I don't know. But it's definitely not a serial killer. Definitely not. But because the higher-ups had that mentality, there was nothing the ones that were lower could do. So I'm going to pop back over to Kim Rossmo. Like a badass, he immediately dug into the case. And he found a pattern. And he told McKay Dunn that, and his supervisor, so McKay Dunn and his supervisor, his last name was Dixon. Again, surnames. I'm a child. They needed to move quickly because there was something going on. So they went up to the next step to Inspector Gary Greer, who immediately agreed. He was like, yeah, we got something going on. So they had to move up to the next step. And this was Deputy Chief Terry Blythe. He didn't oppose to looking into it. But then he had to go to the police chief, which was Bruce Canule. The problem with this was he didn't want to deal with it, so he sent it back to, like, the assistant chief police or whatever, Brian McGinnis. Oh, he was the deputy chief constable of major crimes. McGinnis, again, didn't want to really deal with it, so he sent it back down to Biddlecombe. You know, that asshole who...
Inspector.
Sent it back down to Biddlecombe. You know him. You hate him. And his tiny little dick moves. Motives. Not moves. Tiny little dick moves. That was weird. His tiny little dick motives. He got all the way butthurt. And super defensive because Rossmo was involved. So, McKay, Dixon, and Rossmo went into Biddlecombe's office. They went into his office. They presented to him. Got super pissed off that Rossmo was involved because he was not about that life. He got so pissed that he ended up hitting Rossmo over the head with something.
Oh my God, what a little baby.
Yeah. So Rossmo was like, you know what, that's fine. So he drafted a statement to give to the media that read something along the lines of, some of this I'll quote from the books, but the police were trying to determine if a serial murderer is preying upon people in the downtown east side. The department, of course, refused to release this statement, saying that there were no bodies, so they didn't have a case. But in reality, it was more likely that the victims were in the category of the less dead.
So they're having a pissing contest.
Yes. But Rossmo couldn't do anything without the higher-ups agreeing to it. So again, not everybody was completely ignorant in the police department. Just the ones that weren't actually doing their jobs.
Biddle bitch.
Yep. So a former officer talked about Rossmo, and he said this, and I'm quoting it. So the key to all of this, Rossmo's analysis, if they had followed his analysis and put the best and brightest into it, they would have saved lives.
Yeah, for sure. 100%.
But they just paid lip service. We had an opportunity to save lives, and we blew it. If Kim Rossmo had been given the opportunity to use his science to solve the missing women's case, it would have been canceled. So they were just doing the bare minimum to appease everybody, pat them on the head, oh yes, we're doing our jobs, and then moving on with their lives. They didn't care because it wasn't their family. So since the Vancouver PD couldn't look like they were doing nothing, they told the media that they had a new group working on cases called Project Amelia. They were told this group would be looking into the 40 missing women between 1971 and 1998. Within 6 months of beginning Project Amelia, there were 6 more women added to that list. They had maybe 5 people on this task force. Eventually, it went up to like 9, and then it was brought back down to 6, and then it was disbanded.
What's his face on there?
Rossmo? No. They didn't want to use him. You remember the Piggy Palace Good Time Society?
Right? No.
You remember that? Oh, okay. So this is the place that Dave picked and decided to create a bar in Port Coquitlam, and even having it in a non-profit status for at least a year before they shut that shit down.
And what did they do there?
They threw wild-ass parties.
Biker parties.
Yes. And I'm going to talk about one, actually. That New Year's Eve.
Nice segue, huh?
Yeah. that New Year's Eve, they had a ginormous party. There were 1,500 people estimated.
Holy shit.
To be crammed into this fucking building.
Pigsty.
Yeah. The majority of the partygoers were the Hell's Angels and their associates and sex workers, because I'm pretty sure they had a prostitution ring going on in that area. The city attempted to shut them down again. You know the Pictons didn't give two fucks. They were making a shit ton of money and they weren't going to fucking stop it. Later on, when Willie is arrested, he fondly remembers this party, but not because it was like a good time while he was there. He says that there were 700 people there, and all of a sudden there were like 50 or 60 cop cars full of cops that pulled into the parking area. But it wasn't a raid because he was doing the shit he was doing. The fire marshal was shutting them down because they had too many fucking people in this building.
Yeah.
The fire marshal did more than the fucking police.
Yeah, that's bad.
So, the police department kept fucking around, and more women each month were missing.
Did the police stay and party?
No, they made everybody leave. So, sometime in 1998 or 1999, Willie made a friend. And this friend's name was Andy Bellwood. I don't know why all of them can be brought back to, like, some dick joke, but this is great. Anyway.
Andy a man or a woman?
Andy's a man. So he had a really rough life, really rough past. He had a lengthy criminal history, and he was also addicted to cocaine. He had no place to live, and after attempting and failing multiple times at getting clean from a treatment facility, he made a friend at the treatment facility with Gina Houston's boyfriend. When he got out and he had no place to stay, he stayed with Gina and her boyfriend for a little bit. But then he didn't want to be around their toxic ass shit that they were constantly fighting and stuff. So he somehow managed to get like a truck job or something. So he started staying in his truck. That wasn't great. So Gina was like, hey, why don't you come over to the Picton farm and crash there? They're really generous, you know, whatever. He's like, okay, fuck it.
So he just shows up there.
Well, he does work and stuff for him here and there. He eventually starts living at Willie's full time. And you're probably asking why I'm going on this random ass tangent about this man. There's a reason. So one, I have to name some of the fucking people in the story. There's way too many to name them all, but his story is important. And two, I needed to explain that Willie got real comfy with this man and he started sharing some of his secrets. I also wanted to like give a little background so you would understand, like, he would find
common ground
with him. Yeah. Because he had a rough life or whatever.
Right.
Andy later tells that one February night, he was pretty sure it was 1999, but was also high a lot.
Okay.
So time frames are a little sticky there. Andy says that he and Willie were in Willie's trailer and they were talking, and his story goes a little something like this, and I'm going to quote it from the book. So Andy says, he mentioned about going to get a hooker. I said, no, I didn't. Wasn't really looking for a hooker. Then he proceeded to tell me what he did with hookers. He reached underneath his mattress and grabbed a pair of handcuffs. They're just a metal handcuff, similar to the looks of police handcuffs. They were under his mattress. He pulled out a belt and he pulled out a wire, I believe with a handle on each end of it. It looked like a piano wire. And he proceeded to tell me what he did with these hookers. He told me he would pick them up downtown. He would draw them in with drugs or money. He had difficult times getting them to come to the farm because of, you know, they're very nervous about going out of their area. Yeah, if he could entice them to come to the farm, of course, being drug addict or whatnot, it would be an easy way to get them to come to the farm. He would put them on the bed, bring them into his room. From what he explained to me, do them doggy style in the bed. That would be to have the woman on her knees and her face in the bed, doing her from behind. He would grab their hands and bring one back slowly, bring the other back, handcuff them, and strangle them. He got on the bed and motioned to me as if there was a woman laying there, pretending to stroke her hair, and kind of motioning with his hand how he would grab her hand and bring it around back, although there was no woman on the bed. That's about it. He told me that he was doing them doggy style. He said he was on the bed on his knees. He would just tell them that it was going to be all right. He kept saying, "It's going to be all right. Things are going to be okay now. That's a good girl. And things would be over." He commented on how much people bleed. This hurts my soul. From there, I was told they were taken to the barn, and he explained to me how pigs eat pretty much everything of human remains. Anything that wasn't eaten would go into the barrels and taken to the waste plant with the rest of the waste with the pig waste. I remember him telling me that he'd hang them in the barn and bleed them and gut them. Whatever the pigs didn't eat, he'd throw into the barrel. He would strangle them, gag them. He'd either strangle them with the belt or strangle them with the wire. And then he'd haul them out to the barn. He told this man all of this. Exactly what he was doing. Did this man call law enforcement or police at all?
No.
No. Willie, I don't know what the fuck was wrong with him at that time. He got too comfortable.
So what did the dude do?
Well, later in that conversation, after he told him all of this, he was like, "You sure you don't want to go get a hooker? You sure?" He's like, "No, man, I'm broke. I don't want to do that." So Willie was like, "Hey, I'll give you a couple $100. You can go get a hooker." He's like, "No, I'm not really into getting hookers."
So Willie planned on bringing him into it so that he couldn't tell.
Yeah.
He would be an accomplice.
Mm-hmm. He did not. He like put his foot down. He was like, "No, we're not going." So eventually Willie dropped it. And it's really odd is like he completely dropped the conversation until there was a woman named Lynn that was also living in the home at the time. She came back into the trailer and he brought it up again. He was like, "Oh, Andy isn't a real man because he doesn't want a hooker."
So what'd Lynn say? Who gives a fuck?
Not shit, because she hated Andy. But they got high one time and they fucked, so I don't understand. The information that's in this book, I'm telling you, it's very detailed.
Okay, but could you imagine? Like, does he still have that mattress?
Yeah.
With his stain?
Oh, I don't know. It didn't specify.
Do you imagine getting doggy style?
Face down?
And just looking at that stain?
Yeah.
No. I think I would puke.
Yeah.
Every fucking where.
Yeah. No, that was really hard to read, and I hate it so much. So, like, any tiny little dick man who can't do shit if he thinks that somebody could potentially be stronger than him, he decides to get help. Because, you know, he told him way too fucking much. He can't have him out here just blabbing his mouth. So he decides to get Lynn to call her boyfriend. His name was Ron. And then Ron's friend, Ross, to come to the house and talk to Andy because he's been stealing shit from the back room with all of his tools and shit. So Lynn, Ross, and Ron come up and they're like, "Hey Andy, let's go talk." So he's very apprehensive at this point, but you know, he goes with them because what else is he supposed to do? So he gets in there, they start beating the fuck out of him, asking him where the shit is. He denied stealing anything. Like he's like, I didn't do shit. But then he tried to offer alternatives, like Lynn or even the friend Ross, because they all had access to the back room.
Yeah.
Around this time, they told Lynn, like, just leave the trailer. So she went out and, like, hung out. She later says that she could hear Andy yelling, "I didn't steal anything, stop hitting me." So eventually, they have Andy call his friend Ross to come over. But he comes over on a fucking bicycle. So they're both told, "You have 24 hours to get the stolen shit back here or we're going to kill your ass." So he's like, okay. But before he's allowed to leave to go collect said shit, he has to clean up his own blood from the floor of Willie's office.
Willie has an office.
Yeah, in his little trailer. Before he left, he went over and he talked to Willie and he's like, "I didn't take anything. I didn't take anything from you." So Willie, being the colossal ballsack that he is, played the, "I helped you. I helped you out and you took my shit." So they left Ross on the bicycle and Andy on foot, they made their way to Gina's house. And because she's a special kind of monster, she did the whole I told you so bullshit. Apparently she had told them at some point that bad things happen at the Picton farm.
I thought she was the one who told him to go.
She did. And she still procured women to go to the farm.
Oh my god. So Andy, did he go straight to the police?
No. No. Andy left Port Coquitlam the next morning. And he returned to his mother's home. And when he got there, his brother took him to the hospital. Now, he did eventually file a report, which surprised the fuck out of me. And he never returned to the farm. But apparently nothing ever happened with that report, because obviously Willie was still able to use Lynn and her boyfriend and other friend for shit.
But he told them that he was feeding women to pigs.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That
came out of his mouth.
What year?
1999. Yeah.
And then Willie was arrested.
Mm-hmm.
And put in jail? Mm-mm. Of course not.
No. Willie wasn't arrested for his assault.
No, I know. I'm okay. Just being a smartass.
Yeah. Well, I needed to make that clear because I said, mm-hmm. So around the same time, Lisa Yields, you remember her, right?
Mm-hmm.
She got a phone call from an officer named Ron Palta. But this wasn't the first time that they actually spoke to her. A few weeks earlier, Ron Palta had called her because Bill Hiscock's story about the women's clothing and ID strewn around the house. He told them that Lisa would have more information for them because she lived with him for a little while before she moved out, and she kind of went back and forth for a bit.
Ron's not the same Ron with Lynn, though, right?
Right.
Okay.
Ron is a constable or something. So he calls Lisa about the statements that were made. So it probably wasn't a big shock when he called again. But on March 19th, 1999, officers Ron Palta and Diane McDaniel go to speak to Lisa at her house. Diane McDaniel, randomly, had actually been one of the investigators on the Sandra Gell case. So, like, she knew Willie's past, his violent past. They explained that while they were there again regarding the tip that Hiscox had made and mentioning that Lisa was suspicious of Willie. So they told her a woman, which was actually a friend of hers, had told them that Lisa believes Willie was the one killing the missing woman. So I hate that she didn't go, this is what I know, and just blurt it all out. But you have to remember that she had been around them enough that she knew how violent they could be, especially with their affiliation with the Hells Angels. Actually, that chapter of the Hells Angels were one of the most violent in the area. And if the Hells Angels weren't involved with getting her back if she spoke, Dave Picton would be like the first in line.
Yeah.
So she clammed up and she didn't speak. She didn't give them any information that she could have. And I hate that.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I kind of understand.
Right.
Being empathetic is weird. So apparently after they left, she later tells that she started thinking about it a little bit more. She's like, she really did believe that he was responsible for some of the women. Maybe not all of them, but some of them. And if he was responsible, he could slaughter anything, as she had seen him do, because when she was there with him, she would go out and work in the barn with him. Then that led her down the lovely little rabbit hole of maybe some of the meat he had given me over the years was human, but she still didn't say anything to the police.
It was most definitely human.
If I'm not mistaken, there was a little section of the book that talked about Lisa, like, in depth a lot, actually. But she recalls getting some meat from him one time that she thought was pork, or he said was pork, but it wasn't pork. It was very much a different texture.
I wonder if he sold horse meat, too.
Maybe. That wouldn't surprise me any.
Because he had to put that one horse down.
Yeah. God, that didn't even occur to me.
Oh, I thought of it as soon as you told me about the horse head.
Nice. At this point, there's over 40 women missing, and Willie is doing whatever the fuck he wants to do because he keeps getting away with it, and
the police questioned Lisa, and Lisa didn't say shit.
Clammed up.
Yeah.
So they really don't have anything to work on.
Well, they do, but they just don't give a fuck.
Well, they do, but the frontline workers are doing the damn thing.
Right.
But then when they take it to go further, they meet a brick wall. So on March 20th, 1999, so this is a whole ass month after he has that conversation with Andy about what he does with a hooker. So on March 20th, 1999, he decides to take Lynn Ellingson, which is the woman that was living there, out to eat and get some drugs from Vancouver. And she was like, fuck yeah. He likes to use her to procure his victims. Because a lot of the women, they were very scared at this time. And they wouldn't have gotten into the vehicle with him had he not had Lynn.
Right. Lynn makes you feel safe. Another woman there makes you feel safe.
And she's like, oh yeah, I live there. Yeah. Like, it's good times. So, all Lynn wanted was cocaine. She wanted to get high as fuck. And he was like, sure, let me go pick up a woman and we'll go back to the place. But before he goes and strolls to find the woman, he stops and gets the cocaine.
I'm in love with the cocoa. That just popped in my head. I'm sorry.
He stops, gets the cocaine, goes and finds a woman that he wants. They both do cocaine together. They go buy more cocaine and then head back to Port Coquitlam at the trailer. So when they get to the trailer, Lynn and this other woman, they were just getting high as fuck. Like, they just kept going. I don't even know how they could see at that point, but apparently they could. So he gets tired of watching them, and he takes the woman they picked up to his room. Lynn's like, cool, I'm just gonna go finish this off in my room. Now, the story that I'm gonna tell is super fucked up, and honestly, some people say she's lying.
Who's lying? Lynn?
Yes, Lynn.
Okay.
And honestly, due to her substance abuse issues, her timeline is a little wonky. But we do know that that this is the day. We do know that this was on March 20th because while they were in Vancouver, he got pulled over for swerving. And once the officer was satisfied that he hadn't been drinking, they were like, go home. He didn't go home. He picked up a woman and he went back to his house. So again, all the trigger warnings on this one, because the story's fucking terrible. Lynn tells us that she was in her room when she heard a scream that sounded like it was coming from outside. That's weird. So she gets up and she checks around the house, realizes Willie's door is open, but nobody's in there. So she looks outside. She sees that there's a light on in the barn that, like, not the normal overhead light, but like one that's in the back room, but the door is open enough, whatever. So she's like, oh, I'm gonna go check it out. So she makes her way to the barn. As she gets closer to the barn, she starts smelling this horrendous stench, but she keeps going. She opens the barn door, and all she could see were, and I quote, these legs, these feet dangling. So she froze, and she yelled for Willie. I don't know why the fuck you would yell for Willie, but she fucking did, apparently. I'll quote her telling from here. She says, he came from behind the door, and he grabbed me by my arm. I had to go in. Now we walked to the table. It was a really shiny table. I remember it just being, like, bright. And he made me stand at the end of the table. I remember feeling really not well. I was going to be sick. I had nothing in my stomach, so I was just dry heaving. It was the odor. It was awful. I seen these legs. I didn't move my eyes around. I was just in shock. And at my eye level, I could see these legs, toes, red nail polish on them. They were colored. I seen hair on the table, and I don't know what else was on the table, but it wasn't pretty. She goes on to explain that the normal layout of the barn, like, you walk into the barn, there's a chain that's attached to the ceiling that has a hook on it, and that's where he would take the pigs and he would slaughter them there. He said to me, it's okay. She's just like a pig anyways. It's all right. It's going to be all right. So as she's standing there, I think she's standing there. I don't think he brought her a seat over. And I'm giggling because I am exceedingly uncomfortable. He keeps working. He keeps butchering this woman. And he tells her, you say a word to anybody, do anything, this, you'll be right beside her. She said she was afraid and she wouldn't say a word. She told him, all I want is my dope and my booze. And he eventually walked her to the trailer. And again, gonna quote, I went to grab a bag, just put clothes in it, or whatever. And I said, I'd be back. He said, no, no, no. You know. He gave me $100 and said, like, you can go buy booze or drugs, whatever you want. I'll pay for a cab. I'll call you a cab and you can phone me tomorrow and I'll come pick you up tomorrow. So he called a cab. And I must have walked. Like, he walked with me right up, like, till I got into the cab to make sure I was in the cab. When I got in the cab, my feet were all muddy. The driveway was just muddy. So I got into the cab and went to go buy more drugs. I ended up back in Surrey. I drank. I got high for a few days. I went back. Like, I called him first and told him that I was getting back with Ron. So the thing is, we know that she went back, but we don't know if she went back and stayed for any real length of time. But eventually she did move away from Willie's house.
And she just kept that secret?
He ended up paying her a lot of money to keep that secret. But we do know that she was there on March 29th and May 30th of 1999 because Willie had to call an ambulance because she had overdosed. And so they had to come out there and save her, and they saved her. And this is in 1999, and I just, it's mind-boggling that these people just keep going back. So this woman that he had slaughtered that night was named Georgina Pappin, or at least it's suspected that that is the woman. She was a 35-year-old woman who was the mother of 7 children.
Oh my goodness.
Who had recently, in like the last 6 months or so, had delivered twins. Other people were taking care of her children because
she had substance abuse.
Yes, she wasn't able to take care of them. Like, I think she made the choice to let other people take care of them. Some of the women did. Some of the women that we'll talk about, they made that conscious decision to say, hey, I can't take care of them, and let their family members who would take care of them and meet their needs. And I think she was one of them.
I mean, it's definitely hard to take care of 2 kids. Mm-hmm. So I couldn't imagine 7 kids.
Yeah.
But being a single mom.
But nobody wanted to believe that she was one of the missing women because she was extremely smart and very cautious. But because Lynn was with Willie and lived with him, it would have been okay.
Right. Plus, drugs will make you do some things that you didn't think that you would do.
Nah, it's true. So, Willie is slowly escalating and showing his aggression more and more. A woman named Sharon was one of the last people who saw Georgina, which was on March 2nd.
So, about 18 days before?
Yeah. On March 2nd of 1999. Georgina had told her to come to the Astoria Hotel, where she had a sugar daddy that would come in and buy everybody drugs and beer or liquor or whatever. It turned out that sugar daddy was Willie.
Oh, man.
Sharon had said she was drug sick, and Picton gave her $20 and told her to go get some drugs and come right back. She took the $20 but didn't come right back. But a couple of days later, she happened to walk back into the Astoria, and he was there. He got pissed. He yelled at her, "Fucking junkie ripped me off," and chased after her. He ended up punching her in the side of the fucking head, like to the point where she saw stars, and she avoided him ever since.
In front of everybody?
I'm not sure if he punched her in front of everybody or if, like, she was able to make it out where there was less people, but by the time she, like, could see clearly again, he was gone. So he's slowly losing his shit at this point, and I think this is where I'm gonna leave you for part 2. I'm sorry. There's so much information, and these episodes are going to be long as fuck anyway, but the first episode was more like, this is who was really involved, and this one was a little bit more of a downward spiral for him, but still, police didn't do anything.
Mm-hmm. What are we looking forward to on the next part?
More police incompetence and him getting busted.
Okay, good.
But when he gets busted, the things they find are not pleasant. So, yeah. So hopefully I can wrap up his part of the story in the next one, but probably not. And then I'll go in a deep dive with all the women, and I want their names to be known. So I will try to figure out. I've been searching for the list of his victims, and, like, I have a list, but I wanted pictures. Unfortunately, what we get is, like, that one that I posted where
it's all of them.
It's a big block of faces, but there's no names attached to them.
Yeah.
So I'm going to try and figure out how to put names to those faces and let their stories be told. So,
Sam, that is definitely a full T-Rex episode.
Yeah.
It's going to be hard to go to zero.
Yeah, I don't expect anybody to go back to zero or neutral at this point. So, like, if you have a fun podcast that you listen to or a show, go watch that. Go listen to them. Like we talked about yesterday, Spilling the Crime's a perfect choice for this. It just, yeah.
They just did the Fyre Festival, mm-hmm. and it was really good.
Where the fuck's the cabana?
Yeah, the fucking cabana. Definitely listen to something happy after.
Mm-hmm. But what do you got for me?
I do have some facts for you.
Oh, yay.
Well, some facts about one thing.
Penises.
Close. So, what we're going to end this episode today is with semen.
Of course.
And no, I'm not talking about the dudes in the submarines either.
Well, there was only two options, and you just eliminated the one, so I think we're all cut up.
Now, I want to be inclusive, so when I say dude, I don't mean just guys, because I'm a dude, he's a dude, she's a dude, because we're all dudes.
I love you.
Okay, Sam, okay. What do you know about splooge, or aka baby juice?
That it helps create a baby, and there's fast little swimmers. It's pretty, I don't know exactly what you're looking for.
So, you can actually use semen for other things.
I don't want to.
But you can.
Okay.
Okay, first off, invisible ink.
That's gross, but okay. I guess if you got no other option. Listen.
So first off, I'm going to tell y'all, I found this on a website called Oddie, I think, O-D-D-E-E, and I mean, their articles are just freaking hilarious, first off, but this is where I got it from, and I'm going to read what they put, because literally, it's perfect what they wrote, okay? So, it's really funny, I'm sorry. You wouldn't think war is a situation where nobody would feel like shooting semen.
Correct.
You'd imagine people would stick to shooting guns.
Yeah.
But during World War I, British intelligence services took a leap forward in communications.
A sploosh forward, you mean?
Yes. They discovered that semen could be used as invisible ink.
Wow. Like, I wonder who was jacking off and was like...
Oh, I'll tell you.
Got a little bit on the paper that they were working on and be like, oh shit, look at what he can do.
His name was Mansfield Cumming.
That's a lie.
I swear to God. That's
a porn name.
I swear. That's what it says.
That's the perfect porn name.
It says, fun fact, his name was Mansfield Cumming.
Nice.
There were definite benefits to riding with semen. It didn't react to the usual methods of revealing invisible messages. And most male agents always had an available supply of it. Is this not perfect? It's so funny.
I have so many images in my head and I need them. Ooh. Like, it's terrible. No, it's not. It's not a fun image. But I'll tell you. So... You know how most pens or whatever have, like, the hollow bit where the ink is stored?
Oh, yeah, there's a pen on here.
Like, I just imagine them, like...
Jacking off into it.
Oh, yeah. And then, like, just carrying the pen around. Like, oh, look what I have.
And then they look at... Perfect. Okay. Love it. Shall I keep on going?
Yes, please.
The second one, the second fact that you can use semen for is painting. Why? Both professional and self-proclaimed artists have created paintings with pretty much every available substance.
Okay.
In that sense, it's no wonder that semen ended up on the list as well. But did you know that in 2008, there was an entire exhibit of semen paintings?
Are you serious?
They were all painted by the same artist.
Of course they were.
Martin von Osterwisk.
I needed him to be like Oscar von Sploosh. Like that's.
And I didn't say that name right. Sorry. Oh. The exhibit at the Gay Museum in Berlin featured more than 30 paintings. According to the museum's estimates, Martin Vaughn, I can't say his last
name, fine.
Needed 40 ejaculations worth of semen to complete just one of them. And he had 30.
He was a busy man. a very busy man.
So in total, he needed to blow more than 1,200 loads to create all the artwork.
Oh my God.
And it says, can't say he lacks dedication to his art.
This is true. How long of a period did he paint this? I need to know. I'm sorry.
We'll Google it.
Yeah.
We'll let y'all know. Third. Now, this one says female, but I bet you it could work for both.
Mm-hmm.
Female antidepressant. I feel like it could be a male antidepressant, too.
Probably.
Now, we are fully aware that what you're about to read sounds a bit controversial.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe even sexist.
Mm.
But we're only quoting scientists. So deliver any possible outrage in that direction. I'm telling y'all, go visit Audie. This is so funny. According to a 2002 study.
There was a male scientist.
Oh, for sure. According to a 2002 study, women who came into regular contact with semen were less likely to be depressed.
In their mouths or other places?
The study claims that women having sex without condoms were much less likely to have depression or suicidal thoughts than those who used a rubber. The researchers' conclusion was that women would absorb mood-altering hormones from semen, which made them more cheerful.
Hmm. Okay. Not sure how much I agree with that.
Next.
okay.
Firefighting tool. I told you you were going to love this.
Oh, God, you're on fire.
Yes, that's exactly what I thought. Or somebody yells, fire, and you just start.
Pull it out.
Shake weight.
Oh, God, the
noise. Okay.
Listen, this has been the most amazing ending to this episode.
I bet you that's what he thinks, too. Okay, now, the tests we're about to describe were carried out with fish sperm.
Fish sperm?
Yes.
Okay.
So, we can't vouch that it'll work with human man goo, but it's interesting
that's
nonetheless.
Gross.
Man goo.
It's like a villain in the MCU.
Oh no, it's man goo.
or the porn version of the MCU.
Oh, it's man goo.
Oh, no.
Not the face.
Anyway, but the face.
Okay. In 2015, researchers from Polytechnic University of Turin in Italy discovered that herring sperm doesn't burn.
So
they got the bright idea that it could be used as flame retardant material. So man goo could wear man goo.
Fish man goo.
Indeed, after applying sperm specific DNA to plastics and fabrics, they noticed that it formed a foam at temperatures exceeding 392 degrees. The foam would make the sperm treated material less likely to catch fire. So please don't try to put out a fire by splooging all over it. That's not going to work.
Don't use your own hose.
Don't go splooge on somebody and set them on fire, because that's also not going to fucking work. You splooge in a sock and then you set the fucking sock on.
Who thinks of this shit? Like, let's see what sperm doesn't catch on fire.
Probably the same ones going around licking beavers' anal glands.
Yeah, there's that.
Okay, I've got two more.
Okay.
Sperm is very useful, guys.
Apparently.
Not only can you wear it.
Oh, no.
You can also cook it.
What?
Depending on what floats your boat, you may have already ingested considerable quantities of semen. Ayo! water in my mouth. Oh my god.
It's not toxic or anything, so you could eat it if that's what you're into. Especially when they have pineapples.
Yeah.
It makes it sweeter. Anyways, most of us still wouldn't use it as a cooking ingredient. Well, if they had pineapple smoothie. Yet, there are entire cookbooks. What? There
oh, my God.
I didn't read this part. There are entire cookbooks dedicated to semen-based recipes.
Ew.
For example, Paul Fotenhauer? Fotenhauer? I don't know.
Some guy.
Some guy named Paul has written Natural Harvest. Of course it's a guy. A book featuring 83 pages worth of semen recipes. He also has a book of making drinks and cocktails. Cocktails, and it says ha with it.
What the fuck? Does he use his own recipes?
Does he
use his own
sperm?
Man goo to cook these recipes?
I mean, I'm sure. Semen is not only nutritious, but it also has a wonderful texture.
I expected you to them to say, it's not only nutritious, it's delicious.
I'm getting there. But it also has a wonderful texture
mm-hmm.
and amazing cooking properties.
Mm-hmm.
Like fine wine and cheeses, the taste of semen is complex and dynamic.
Wow.
Really opened your mind there.
Not really.
I wonder if Gordon Ramsay gave him to taste something. What is that spice you taste there, Gordon Ramsay?
That's gotta be illegal. Like feeding your man goo to
Gordon Ramsay.
What if he says
that's the most fucking delicious thing he's ever eaten in his life? I rather like that. What is it?
Oh my god.
Man goo.
Man goo.
Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, man goo. Last but not least, this is my favorite.
Oh man.
Facials. Skincare product.
What?
Yes. You can get a semen facial.
I really wish we had a video.
Oh, get your mind out of the gutter. We're talking about skincare.
No, mine is definitely in the gutter.
This ain't a porno.
We're talking about semen and I have the, what's the word I'm looking for?
Humor of a 13-year-old.
Yes, that's okay. It.
Semen contains an unimaginative baby named antioxidant called spermine.
Can I keep the part where you have the...
Yeah, because okay. I totally nailed that. And according to particularly kinky skincare professionals, it can reduce wrinkles, smoothen your skin, and even help with acne and other skin problems.
Huh.
See? Just get splooshed on some more. Granted...
Not the face.
If you do... The face. Granted, if you do get a spermine facial, nobody will be slathering actual semen all over your face. Every health code following spa will use synthetic spermine made in a safe and sterile laboratory environment. Whatever. They got Jose in the back. Don't fucking lie to me.
They got Goo Man. What are you talking about?
But just so you know, there aren't any actual studies into spermine's skincare benefits, but... Don't actually expect to get rid of acne by taking a few loads to the face. But if you're already into that and you happen to get smooth skin, you know.
Now you know where it came from.
Yeah. Do you, boo. Magu.
Facials.
Facials. Yeah, that was good, wasn't it?
That was fantastic. I'm so happy that you... That was the best way to go back to neutral. I was on the fence. Like, I didn't know if I could come back from that, but you...
Semen will do it to you.
Semen will do it every time.
Man goo.
Man goo.
A little acne
sure. I'm gonna have to find some splooge. Listen, when we finally post pictures of our faces and you see they're very smooth and soft, mind your business.
It's a filter.
Non-cool.
Oh, God, that was terrible and funny all at the same time. This will be the best part to edit, too, because it'll just make me so happy.
You're gonna, like...
I'm leaving all the random laughter in it, too.
So, if you've stuck with us for this long, you're welcome.
Yeah. You're welcome. Oh, shit, that was great.
Awkward.
That was a little awkward. All right, so if you would like to contact us and tell us...
how you use splooge. No, I'm just kidding. Don't
please
do that.
Don't. No. Please don't.
Tell us your skincare products.
I can't. No. Don't do any of that shit. Contact us and tell us a story that you would like us to tell, or
a splooge story.
Not a splooge story. Oh my God! You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, and the Twitter.
We also have emails. No, we have one email.
An email.
It's m3truecrimepod@gmail.com.
This is true.
Send the splooge stories there.
Please don't.
Sam checks the email first normally, so do it.
Oh my God. No, if you do put in the title splooge story, and
Sam,
I'll make
first.
Sure that Paige can Paige can get those.
No, put not splooge story. I swear, not splooge story.
I swear.
Mango.
Oh, I'll link the link tree in the episode notes. And I think that's it. I think I'm done. Okay.
Bye!